Hi, everybody. This is The Curious Quant. And I'm here on this beautiful winter's or indeed summer's day with Igor. How are you, sir?
Thank you very much. Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Now, you've had a really interesting career, and we were just chatting before we started. And there's a lot here that I'm going to unpack in a moment. But tell me a little bit about your background in terms of how you've come to be here. The kind of, I suppose, the educational background to the kind of professional background that you've had?
Yeah, my professional background was kind of not very, common, if you wish. So I spent a long time in academia, maybe too long. So I did a PhD in theoretical physics. And after that, somehow, I did two postdocs in physics. Until I realized that, prospects of getting a job in academia are very slim, and I decided to move to the industry and find something that would be, mathematically heavy, interesting, and also paying. And initially I thought about electrical engineering, but I found it too boring. And then I came in the bookstore, I came across the book by John Hall called Futures, Options, and Other Derivatives, which kind of drew my interest.
The Bible, isn't it?
Yeah. I was not able to read this book. It was it was not written in a style which is, common for physicists, because he immediately jumps into, numbers. So whenever he explains something, he jumps into examples and two lines below, I already lost what was $100 and what was $150. Right? In science, we used to, use letters as notations and apparatus formulas. But anyway, so this is how I started in finance. And I worked as a quantitative analyst for Bloomberg for 4 years. Then I moved to JP Morgan, where I spent about 14 years as a credit quant. And then I took an academic break. I taught at NYU for a couple of years. I created a course on machine learning in finance, which is available right now on Coursera. And last year I started at Fidelity, where I do AI at the moment.
Brilliant. And I especially like this term that I think you coined in the conversation just before we started, which was a radicalized contrarian.
Yes.
which I thought was interesting, because in some sense, it's almost by definition all true. Like all the contrarians I've worked with over the years have had a sense of resistance against the social norms. And that resistance against social norms is in some sense a self-fulfilling criteria. So the more people push you, the more there is hurting in a particular idea or belief, the more resistant you are to it in some sense, the more you don't want to be as part of that. But tell me a little bit about, I suppose, this idea about where it comes from.
How I got radicalized?
Yeah.
Yes. It was a kind of, slow process. As I said, I came to finance from physics, and the first books that I read in finance, the best books that I found most useful were books by Paul Wilmot, who's himself a applied mathematician, right? So when I learned about black holes, I got very excited. Such a beautiful model, based on diffusion equation, connected to, Einstein diffusion, and Bachelier, who did it 5 years ahead of Einstein, which takes a special pride, among financial mathematicians, et cetera, right? Until I got to the point that actually doesn't work, right? It doesn't work in a pretty dramatic way, right? So the whole model is wrong. And everyone knows that, just people don't realize how much it's wrong, right? And it's wrong, actually, my conclusion was it's wrong qualitatively, not quantitatively, but qualitatively.
So the why do you think it's just quickly, why do you think it's qualitatively wrong? It's an interesting, I haven't heard it described that way before.
The reason it's wrong qualitatively, because it misses in my humble opinion, it misses the whole essence of the business. The common wisdom of the market is, there is a business only when there is risk, right? My favorite book called Traitors, Guns and Money tells this story about a German professor who was hired by a German bank to assess bank's risk. So it took him like a month of hard work, and then he showed up in front of the board, said, you know, guys, I made my calculations. You have zero risk. And
yes.
And yeah, and the CEO said, you know, Herr Professor, with all due respect, I sincerely hope that you are wrong, because if we have no risk, we have no business, right? So actually, the story with Black Scholes is exactly the same, right? So according to Black Scholes' model, options have zero risk, right? Everyone knows that, but everyone believes that it's kind of okay, because they appeal to equilibrium in the market, blah, 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 right? But in my opinion, just washes out the whole essence of the thing, right? So you can't give a number and say that this is the option price. It's not a unique number, it's a range, right? You have risk. You have risk of mishedging.
Right. So yeah, this is about an error bounder.
Part of the output of the model. And this part was entirely lost in the classical Black-Scholes model. So essentially, what they ended up with was purely mathematical model, right? Which gives the limit of the correct problem, but this limit is almost totally not interesting. It's very deficient, right? So my opinion, they lost half of the whole thing. By ended up with just one equation that gives just one number. So this is how I kind of got radicalized.
This is I suppose quite a common, it's a reasonably common thing, isn't it? Like you in 2008, as an industry, as a risk industry, let's say, there was a serious critique over the value at risk model, the VAR models, right? But essentially the entire industry had come to accept that a single number characterized risk. And in fact, the people who are generating these models, or the people who understood the models, would tell you, well, no, that's one part of the picture, and then there's a distribution, and there's other assumptions, one can vary. And essentially, the risk management is essentially like a mosaic. You have many different elements that are kind of come together to give you a fuzzy picture of roughly where you are. But as an industry, it wasn't interested in fuzziness. It wasn't interested in diversification distribution. It was interested in a given number. It said, please tell me exactly what my risk number is. It's 42, it's 35, it's whatever it is. And the entire industry kind of became fascinated with that idea. So it lost this nuance, it lost this range, it lost this uncertainty level. But I kind of still see that today. I see that, and maybe you can disagree or agree, that we still, as human beings, continue to strive for certainty, even from extremely uncertain systems and uncertain outcomes. And there's one of my favorite books, Super Forecasting, which I often talk about in this podcast, kind of makes this distinction that people that have a single narrative and a single story and a single number often seem a lot more certain and believable and trustworthy as an emotive response than somebody who comes to you saying, this is the range and it's approximate and it's just one part of the story and there's a lot of things we don't know. Even though that's a more correct reflection of reality, it does not induce a feeling of security and safety and does not make good headlines, does not make good film reviews, and so on. So therefore, I kind of wonder whether in that context we're still in the same problem, that we've got this massive behavior bias.
Yeah, I believe yes. So the situation with derivatives is in a sense even worse than with VAR, because VAR at least gives you one risk number. Derivatives, the classical derivatives theory, gives you no risk number, right? It's a big difference between zero and one. Okay, at least, right? The second thing, to your point, I'm not an expert in neuroscience, but according to what I read in popular science, the tendency to organize things in patterns, to look for patterns, is our nature, actually, right? It helps us, right? Because all these heuristic rules that we create are actually kind of, in the language of AI, machine learning, we see something similar, right? It's some sort of, dimension reduction, you call it aggregation, clustering, etc., right? So we tend to see patterns even when there are no patterns, right? So if you look at, you know, scattered points on a plane long enough, you will see a pattern.
Right. So, well, exactly. There's a great great movie. We were talking about quotes before. Before I lose this quote, I will mention it in a minute. But one of my favorite films is this film called Pi. I don't know if you've heard of it before. It's a wonderful black and white film, right? And it's got this beautiful quotes in there, the mathematicians talking about, once you start to see a pattern, you start to see it everywhere. That the fact that this mind is a pattern finding generation algorithm, and essentially is constantly looking for patterns. And then once it thinks it's identified a pattern, it then finds it everywhere. It kind of superimposes it in everything we look around you. And I think maybe this is one of those areas where at the heart of a lot of forecasting is the battle between human cognition, which is trying to tell us that there is a pattern here, that I think I see something, versus machine cognition in some sense, if we can call it that, or machine pattern recognition. Mm-hmm. That says the same, but it may not be intuitive to us. I mean, how do you think about pattern rec? Does it, in order for us to trust a pattern, does it have to be intuitive to us? Do we have to be able to kind of look at it and go, yeah, I can kind of see that, but the machine saw it quicker, or, you know, it saw it in higher dimensions or something? Or can we step back and go, you know what, it's fine?
You know, it's a great question, actually. I think I kind of, you know, in my career, I fluctuated between different extremes here. Right, like my current view of this is that we do need interpretability. We can't proceed without, especially in finance, right? I'm not sure about other tech applications, right? But finance needs interpretability at least for two reasons, right? One is formal, regulatory, right? Another one is informal, a kind of common sense, right? And I think why we need this, because we simply cannot trust any, you know, black box type of algorithms, even though, you know, they pass all the standard, like, you know, you train, you validate, and then you apply it for the test set. It's not enough, right? Because it's not enough because we never certain about the, you know, all the all the variables that we include, right? So you know, I know that you mentioned COVID-19 and implications, et cetera, right? So actually, this event itself brought me to think again about all these relations between what is called risk and what is called uncertainty, right? So people sometimes do not differentiate between these, right? These two. And still there is a very clear distinction, right? So when you have a probabilistic system where all states are known, but you know probabilities, this is called risk, right? But in a situation when you simply don't know the states, the future states, right? Then this is called naivety and uncertainty. So you and in some way, COVID. I had a few interesting discussions with colleagues whether it should be called black swan or not black swan. And I think it's not black swan at all for some people, but for some it is apparently. And I think the difference is that, if we think of, you know, classical asset management models, if they don't look at, you know, if they don't have any variable called virus, you know, they have no idea what comes in a month, right? So for models like that, the event like this would be totally black swan. On the other hand, if we somehow like were smart to integrate these models into financial models, then it would not be black swan. I think it's a tricky question.
Well, it's an interesting one because I don't know about the definition necessarily of black swan or not, but I do get a sense that originally the idea of a black swan was a kind of an extreme draw from a distribution. So you thought you knew the distribution and you got an extreme draw from the distribution, left tail or something like that.
Not quite black swan. This is like...
No? Good. Tell me.
Yeah. These things are... these things come under different names. They're called extreme events or rare fluctuations. at least you know the distribution, right? You can look at, you know, large deviations, even in simple, you know, stochastic processes like Brownian mush or something like that. Uncertainty is something more than that. It's exactly the statement about, you know, our limited knowledge about the states of the world themselves, right?
No, 100%. And I think just so we're clear, my point is, you think you know, let me rephrase, you think you know the distribution of something, then you get a draw from it that makes you question that you knew the distribution of that something, right? Or the fact that the distribution didn't change because the distributions themselves don't have to be time invariant. But I guess the distinction I want to make very quickly is maybe not a statistical one, but a one about whether an outcome like a COVID type response comes endogenously from a system or comes exogenously. So in my mind, at least, I think about the financial crisis in 2008 as an endogenous crisis. Like there was a series of latent pressure inside the system. Yes. And then eventually it kind of bubbled, broke some critical thresholds and became priced and became known. And the magnitude of that movement was kind of incredible when you looked at the time series of numbers that were flat, 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 and then suddenly spiked. There's nothing in the historic distribution that told you that, but that's because it was latent. It was underneath the surface, and there's other kind of indicators that steam was coming out of the system. Right. Whereas I think with COVID or an asteroid strike or something exogenous to the financial system that comes externally, and in this case, the response actually was more of a geopolitical risk, I would almost term it as, because the response on the economy was largely a function of the political response to the policy response. So therefore, it was this the stress test in some sense was what happens if we just turn our economy off?
You know, that was the stress. Yes, exactly.
Oh, yeah, well, that's what happens. Boom. Oh, well, maybe we should do that. Let's go and put it back in again. Yeah, so it's sort of, in that context, it was a stress test, but it was an exogenous stress test. And that's why when I think about the response post-COVID, you know how after 2008, we had like a load of regulation for banks. We had a structural change in risk-taking for different agents and capital and so on as a kind of response and various regulatory responses around governance. And you had a change of that industry landscape, essentially, especially in the US, happened. Whereas, for example, post-COVID, I struggle to see the same things. I struggle for us to sit here in 2-3 years and say, well, we had our economy or our financial system incorrectly set up and we need to make some changes. I think it's more likely that we're going to say, oh, we need to spend more money on healthcare or something. And therefore, it's a more of a kind of a governmental policy type response for the government spending versus a financial services thing. And so therefore, when I think about Black Swan in that context, rightly or wrongly, I think about Black Swans as a unknown, so it's kind of like a, you know, left field thing that hits you and you go boom, you respond, but you don't expect it to come again, and you legitimately think it's idiosyncratic. It didn't come from within your system. It didn't bubble up. So I do think about it as a Black Swan event for that reason. Although again, you can kind of argue it, I'm sure, differently. I'm sure you guys have as well. But tell me a little bit about, so I'm going to switch gears a little bit to the other favorite topic of yours, which is reinforcement learning.
Yes.
Because I've heard a lot of talk about it. It's a very exciting field in the machine learning world. And I certainly see a lot of data science people thinking about how to apply it within games and game systems, or responsive game systems. How does one think about it in the context of finance or financial services? Like, where have you seen these type of methodologies being applied or thought about in our world?
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. So I actually, like, my initial interest in reinforcement learning was inspired not even by reinforcement learning itself, but rather by a version of it called inverse reinforcement learning. So basically, inverse reinforcement learning is all about understanding intent of agents given their behavior. And this, like, sounds like totally holy grail of everything, right? If you think about it, it's a holy grail of finance, a holy grail of marketing, of business. Like, you know, give me the utility of the agents and I will be able to sell them anything, right? Okay. So in my previous job, my kind of my initial interest was like to I wanted to understand behavior of FDIC, which is Federal Deposit Insurance Company. Right? What is the utility function of them in them taking decisions about closing or not closing banks? Because I was in credit, that was my focus right there. But then, like when I started to teach, I decided like to put it on a wider base, and because it was obvious to me that actually the whole of quantitative finance can be restated in the language of reinforcement learning. It's all about reinforcement learning if we think about it, right? So the classical concept of finance is based on first forecasting, right, and then acting based on this forecast, right? So you have clearly a sequence of steps, right? But your actual goal is to act optimally, right? It's not to forecast. There is not such objective as forecasting for the sake of forecasting, right? So reinforcement learning approach puts this ordering between these two tasks in the proper order, because it emphasizes the need, the main objective of reinforcement learning is how you act optimally. So in the context of trading, is how you trade optimally, right? Now, what you do about your forecasting part is actually up to you. So in reinforcement learning, there are various ways to go about that point. You can do model-free reinforcement learning, which says basically, I don't care about the model of my work. I just take data as it is and use it for my decision making. This is called model-free reinforcement learning. And another approach is called model-based reinforcement learning, which says, oh, actually, it's good for me to have some internal model of the world, but still, this model is subordinated to my main task, right? So I have a very clear perspective of what is main objective and what is subordinated objective. That's why I like this approach. So conceptually, everything, like we just released a book, actually, it's coming out next week, a textbook on machine learning and finance, where we made the whole chapter devoted to applications of reinforcement learning for quantitative trading, where we actually explain three most classical applications of quantitative trading, namely portfolio optimization, wealth management, and derivatives pricing. All of them can be very naturally restated, rephrased in the language of reinforcement learning. And this provides lots of, you know, potential for better numerical schemes, more efficient schemes, like less model-dependent schemes, et cetera, et cetera. So definitely, my view is that reinforcement learning is absolutely the most adequate way to do finance in general. I mean, everything, literally.
But I think that's a really interesting point, because so if I can pause here for a second. So the idea of understanding the other agent's utilities or the kind of other side.
Oh, this is inverse reinforcement learning. We didn't come to this.
Oh, yet. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, yes. This was about direct reinforcement learning, the most classical area, right? Mm-hmm. Which basically is appropriate when you know your utility function or agent's utility function. You just want to, given this utility function, you want to maximize it over the course of actions, you know. But inverse reinforcement learning is exactly the inversion of this problem when you're an agent and you don't know, you have no clue. You see the you know, the states of the world, you see the environment, and you see actions taken by this agent. But you have no idea why those actions were taken. So you don't know the utility. You want to infer this utility from actions. This is inverse reinforcement learning, right? So let's say you observe trades. You observe trades by Jim Simons or whoever, right? Just for the sake of argument, right? And then you put it into your algorithm, and then it produces you like AI version of Jim Simons.
So that's an interesting question. So when we say agents, Can it be an artificial agent or a system?
Yeah, it can be either. Yeah, it, absolutely. Yes, it can be either a human agent or it can be artificial agent. So you can infer. Actually, there were some research by other people who applied inverse reinforcement learning to learn automated trading strategies.
Yeah, because essentially what you're trying to do is to, I suppose, draw a chalk outline around something that is acting a certain way to understand its characteristics. Yeah. And so therefore, you could, I mean, given that so much algorithmic trading happens, given that some of these are rules-based, some of them are just execution algorithms, but it's an interesting one to understand whether you can back out, obviously, you know, different types of utility functions or just response functions, maybe more specifically. So, you know, some exogenous shock happens, and then what is the response function across a bunch of different agents in a bunch of different areas? I just wonder, I suppose, whether these type of algorithms would therefore need for me to be able to observe and the actions of an agent, just like you just said in your example. And if I can only observe an aggregate price of a collection of agents, whether I could still talk something about those agents. So for example, you know, as a clearing price for an auction, for example, in a particular market, I've got a whole range of agents coming in and creating that bid and ask equilibrium and sort of some kind of price in the middle. And most often I can maybe observe the trading book, maybe, but I guess a lot of times I probably can only observe the price in any given moment. And therefore I'm kind of dealing with some kind of aggregated information bundle of a collection of agents acting. Are these methodologies, do they require me to observe a single agent in terms of...
This is actually a great question, and thank you for asking that. The story is actually pretty funny because I was working, like I was thinking about this algorithm, and like we spent with my co-author, we spent lots of time thinking about that and, you know, discussing various versions, and finally we got the algorithm. And I told him, okay, we have the algorithm, let's try. Do you have trading data from investors? He said, I don't have any trading data. I have market data. And I said, what can I do with your market data? And I was very upset, and I started to think, but then I got an idea actually. The idea was that you can apply the same idea essentially to the market as a whole. So it's kind of like, you know, I called it the invisible hand model, because it's kind of an invisible hand. You can think of the whole market dynamics as some sort of, you know, aggregated effect of all traders in the market.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Yeah. So in this sense, and actually we ended up with a kind of model, which is a little bit like, to me, it's still kind of a little bit mysterious, or maybe if you wish, theological, because it kind of appeals to the concept of kind of a market which has a mind.
Yeah, 100%.
The invisible hand is an agent, actually, is an agent on its own, right? So we map the whole market dynamics onto actions of a single agent.
Yes.
The funny thing is that if you can do this, right? So, and we came up with a reasonable model actually for market dynamics. The funny thing, why I call it like mysterious or theological, is because this agent doesn't have a counterparty. So it plays with itself. So imagine you, like, this is what I did when I was a kid, when I was bored. I took a pack of cards, right? And start playing with myself, right? Left hand versus right hand, right? So the same thing. So you can think of the actions of this agent as a kind of self-play.
It's like I'll put it even more theologically for you. It's the dreaming Buddha, you know?
Yes, yes, exactly. Yes.
And, you know, because I was going to say, when I was asking about the artificial agents or systems, you know, again, a conceptual question might be, can we back out the utility of the market or the response function of the market as a way of characterizing the market? If the market was a person, what would they be like? How short-term would they be? How reactive are they? How, you know, all of these different elements. Because it's interesting that we understand that the market is this complex system of many, many different objectives and voices being aggregated in all kinds of nonlinear ways. Yet we still refer to it as an entity, as a single entity. The market did this, or the market says this, or the market's not pricing this. As if we imagine that there's a, you know, a very high level entity. It's like a kind of a capitalist god, if you will, right. Free market god, kind of sitting there thinking about the world. But I certainly have a lot of, time and empathy for models that are trying to understand the system as a whole, as a kind of system dynamic, and therefore to back out its characteristics, its frailties, its elements as a mechanism for pricing things or as a mechanism for risk management, to understand the system that is producing these type of outcomes. And prices are an exhaust of that outcome, but they're not. The system as a whole kind of has many more latent characteristics inside of it. Mm-hmm. So do you see kind of reinforcement learning, or this particular form of reinforcement learning, then as a mechanism by which you try to imply the strategies of others, and it becomes even more in some sense adversarial or predictive in terms of you're trying to understand the utility function, the higher level utility function of an agent that is taking actions? So you're not trying to predict an action necessarily, you're trying to understand at the higher level, but ultimately by doing so you will be using that information to create prices, to create actions that then drive that agent into a different types of actions or different types of outcomes. I mean, that's the traditional way in which this idea of adversarial traders who are trying to understand each other, the high frequency stuff, everything else in that category, has been phrased. So is that the type of phrasing that we still have, or is it something else?
Is it the type of, I'm not sure actually. I'm not working in high frequency trading. That's like, you know, my professional interest are in long-term asset management. This is what I do. If you're asking like, if a part of your question is like, what will happen if everyone will use such sort of a model in order to infer anything that can be inferred about, you know, counterparties. There are some, you know, theoretical limits to this, right? Because like trades, unless you trade OTC, right? So your trades are anonymous, right? So you don't see your counterpart, right? You can make some reasonable inferences who trades against you, but it's very limited, right? So in this sense, like some people look into multi-agent market models, which is a popular topic these days. And I think I like, as an ex-physicist, I certainly like those models. I just think that they are kind of for practitioners, they're heavy, and usually they're not able to produce much beyond, you know, some stylized facts, if you wish, right? But I think like what seems more promising to me, at least, again, as an ex-physicist, in physics, there's a concept of mean field approximation, where you basically say you have a complex system, but as long as you're interested in one element of this system, like one particular trader, right, you aggregate all the rest of traders into some sort of environment, right? So, and this is pretty adequate, right, to most of the problems. So it's you against the market, essentially, right? So the adversarial agent is the market, basically, right? So, you know, these are all very new things, right? We don't have much experience. I think like it seems very promising as a direction. Like how much it will produce in practice still remains to be seen, right? So
because I think it's, you know, with the amount of data that we have now in various different areas and fields, yeah, growing and growing and growing, it feels like the computing power and the data push is going to push us into an element of understanding things much more dynamically and much more interactive, endogenously, if you will. And it's a stark contrast to the rest of the industry, who talks to the idea of priced risk factors and equilibria concepts, you know, kind of drawn from the financial literature, where, you know, if you buy a certain asset price, if you buy a certain risk, you are compensated for that in the long term. And that happens without any agents, without any mechanisms. And it kind of reminds me very much of the evolution of finance as well, in the sense that you had these equilibrium models that said, you're trading, you're kind of playing against off a a board of equilibrium prices, and you could choose which ones that you want to take, i.e. high risk or low risk, but there's no agents, there's no dynamics, there's nothing. And then the advent of the dynamic models that then came along from Kyle in, I think, 88 paper and onwards, which would touch more about the game theoretic back and forth, higher level orders, what I think you'd think about me kind of ideas, mm-hmm. and these type of kind of games that took it to a high level, which then became a lot more about forecasting the other person's forecast of you idea. Right. And that then became an information game or information war about predicting not only what the other person thinks, but what they're likely to do, maybe how they react to exogenous factors and so on, with very little information about fundamentals, with very little information about what's happening economically, earnings-wise, but purely a kind of a, almost like a zero-sum game there. And I wonder whether, I suppose, with machine learning, an element of machine learning is going to be give us more tools for that element of finance to say, okay, we've got more data, we've got more algorithms to be able to detect people's actions, reactions. Therefore, this type of higher level strategic element is just going to kind of escalate. And if you think about, you know, before I pass it over, if you think about, I suppose, you know, the successes of machine learning, or one visible success of machine learning, certainly has been in the game Go and chess and all these other elements, which have tried to do this type of incremental, I suppose, guesses or in probabilistic guesses as to, you know, likely action reaction outcomes. And this is much, much more complicated than that. So that's a terrible summary of what they do, but you get the idea that it's a kind of an adversarial achievement versus a kind of, I understand the system, because in those games that system is given to them and they just have to be, you know, beat the adversarial elements of it. I mean, where do you see this heading? Do you see this field giving more understanding of the world and the top down and the system that drives prices and earnings and companies or whatever? Or do you see it more heading toward an adversarial system or series of enablements where the future fund manager has these incredible systems to understand the other fund manager who's trading against or the other algorithm they're trading against better than the fundamentals?
I hope it will be the second one, right? So especially given you know, if I believe that if these ideas work, that definitely should give market participants more information about what else happens in the market, right? But the other, your other question about like kind of what does this whole new brave world bring to us? Like, what about these fancy machine learning tools? You know, my favorite analogy is like, machine learning is extremely powerful, right? But because of that, it's both good thing and a dangerous thing, right? Think of like, you know, think of you, you know, if you drove many years Toyota Corolla and then all of a sudden you find yourself in a Ferrari, right? You might have, you know, lots of fun, but it can kill you because you don't have skills, right? The same thing here. It might be lots of fun, but you can make horrible mistakes with machine learning if you don't understand what you do with that.
But surely that isn't that kind of, I suppose that's part of the whole two steps forward, one step back type of evolution that we see, unless you don't have any speed signs on the road, right? So it's your Ferrari is a problem if everybody can speed as much as they want. We're on autobahns or whatever. And then there's a systematic problem that these systems can cause. And that's been a kind of core question, I suppose, for regulators. Should we be worried about the advent of machine learning in financial services, in markets, and so on? Are they going to cause greater volatility? Are they going to cause greater concentrations and various other kind of questions? On a systematic level, rather idiosyncratic. Yeah. People are out to experiment, right? They can experiment, they can blow up, that's absolutely fine. The question really is whether, you know, we're going to have these very adversarial systems that create volatilities that then have, unfortunately, policy reactions attached to them.
Well, you know, maybe I think like, well, in general, I think it would be correct to say that, you know, all technical innovations so far only contributed to the increased volatility, right? because the latency goes down, right? The hardware improves, software improves, et cetera, right? So that's on one hand. On the other hand, it might be that we will eventually face something like, you know, AI arm race in a sense, right?
100%.
Yeah, 100%. But in this particular case, I would rather imply like AI arm race between, not between traders, but rather, you know, maybe between traders and regulators.
Sure.
It's also possible, right? Because they kind of, there is a need to contain this you know, this potential splashes of market volatility, all those flash crashes, et cetera, right? So how you monitor it, right? So this paper actually that I mentioned to you in the beginning of our conversation about IRL was written in 2016 by folks from MIT. And what they actually had in mind was monitoring the exchange. So one of the targeted use of their model was for regulators.
It's a fascinating problem because again, you're absolutely right. So it can be thought of as a kind of detection system where you're trying to understand the implications of someone's actions, and therefore what you're really trying to do is identify bad agents in an economy or a system. I also wonder whether a lot of this stuff could be used to profile government agencies or central bank agencies' interventions in markets. Because as you said, you're not just trading against other traders, you're trading against agencies. And those agencies have pretty specific rules or pretty specific actions that they take based upon market outcomes. I get a little bit nervous about systems that detect other systems and that benefit off them, because ultimately, you know, other than the corner solutions, which is that, you know, you kind of goad another player into selling so that you can make money from them selling, but you don't care about what happens to those prices. So mm-hmm. if prices are 10% lower, you've made money, you don't care. You've won, but there's
right. prices
are lower or 10% higher or whatever else it is. And that's okay if we're talking about Bitcoins or other things which are purely there to be traded on and to have speculation attached to them. I find that difficult when there's a kind of a Merton type model where if the equity price goes a certain level, then there's a bankruptcy or there's a government intervention or there's a corporate action that gets taken. And at that time, there's real consequences from that random little number on your screen moving 10% mm-hmm. down, 20% down. And you see that occasionally. I remember back in, I like to say 2012, but I'm probably wrong. I was looking at some pricing in the emerging markets, specifically in frontier markets and emerging markets. And you had these price patterns where a series of indices were sold off and they lost about 20%, something like that. And there were no obvious reasons. There was no news. There was no information about those economies doing badly. There's no companies that did badly. Nothing. And although you didn't know, you kind of thought, well, this is coincides really well with a certain taxation cycle in the US system. Mm. So probably a bunch of traders went, oh, you know what, we need to liquidate those positions and move them out and whatever. So for them, it was a couple of hundred million. Those couple of hundred million being transacted overnight in these emerging markets meant the markets went down 20%. And those central banks were probably the next morning contemplating how they're going to shore up the market or what they have to do or whatever else, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the kind of butterfly wings flapping over there. Well, it's actually more direct than that. But the idea is that it's completely different incentives by a different set of agents with real economic consequences on the other side. So I do wonder, therefore, whether this machine learning, if machine learning continues to grow in that type of adversarial trading element, whether as a society we'll start to entrust less and less into the equity markets.
Quite possible.
Yeah. And that would be quite interesting. So we're coming to the end of our podcast, but I really want to ask you another question because I haven't asked you enough questions today. And this is a kind of a broader question, but I often ask my guests, including, by the way, Paul, who was on the show. Wilmot was on our podcast. That was a great conversation. Very philosophical, actually, in the end. Really, really interesting but very philosophical question conversation we had. So in terms of the advent of more AI in our society, the machine learning in our society, and in various different levels, whether it's in financial services, whether society and other mechanisms, I mean, what do you think are the biggest opportunities or concerns that the greater advent of AI presents in our society going forward?
What are the major concerns or what are the major
opportunities? Any side of that equation that you want to take, it's just a kind of a thought from you about what in that field's advancements into the various areas of our society gives you either pause or gets you very excited.
Well, I think all major technical innovations in the past, they always were causes for both excitement and concerns, right? So take atomic energy, take anything. Right? So I think the same here, right? So there is obviously lots of excitement just about, you know, excitement about something new and unknown coming, right? So we have no idea actually how our industry will look like in 10 years from now, correct? So my expectation is that, like, you know, last year we had a great, it was organized by, what's the name of this company that does NLP processing? There was a discussion which was inspired by a book by Yuval Harari. The discussion was whether we're going to have a useless class of financial professionals anytime soon. And it was a great
you mean more useless? Or?
even more useless, exactly, right. So the discussion was around how kind of to avoid this fate, right? How not to become useless, right? Because what we see is that, simple professions are being replaced by machines with an amazing speed, right? So I think it was Andrew Ng who said that, like, all tasks which take, you know, planning horizon of 2 minutes are already either automated or about to be automated, right? So in finance, like, algorithmic trading is largely automated, right? But long-term asset management is not. And the reason for that is that, you know, there is so much more uncertainty and less room to formalize things into some set of predefined rules for longer horizon than for shorter horizon, correct? So I think that at the end, we will prove to be not useless, but kind of useful, right? At least as, as coders for machines, but hopefully for more. So I really believe in some sort of, you know, symbiosis between humans and machines at the end, right? So definitely they are so far away from replacing us in most of what we do, as long as, you know, we don't do simple things like, you know, shuffling boxes in the storage or, you know, driving, you know, trucks, right? We are not in immediate danger, but we are in a potential danger, right? So this is one thing. Probably the main philosophical question for humanity is how to, you know, live going forward, right? Whether everyone needs to work or we can afford, like, you know, welfare state where machines will work, they will pay taxes, right? And everyone else will be free not to do anything.
It's a really interesting one. I mean, I suppose I do a lot of work now in the future of work area with the company I'm at, which is called Fathom. And, this idea of you can kind of quantify, as you said, the kinds of tasks that can be done in a machine or automated way. And you can really start to ask the question in an economy that strives for scale, the scalability of activities, you inevitably end up breaking down tasks and activities and therefore human capital into a series of decisions, a series of actions, and then seeing how you can take those and scale them through technology or just through specialization and things like that. So we're almost like very set up to be automation ready or to be kind of handing this stuff over constantly. But it also kind of shines some really interesting questions about inequality. And under the current system, we're also very set up for the gains to those scale to accrue to corporations or individuals, as opposed to being kind of broadly shared or broadly distributed. And I feel like, you know, differently put, there's a question about being useful. So that's one element of this, which is, am I going to be useful in the future if a lot of my activities can be replaced or done quicker, better? Secondly, perhaps is, will I be empowered? So even if I'm not useful, maybe I'm empowered because I have some money, I have opportunity, I have education. If I'm not empowered, then I'm getting universal basic income to consume. And that's my role in the future. And, you know, I don't think anything's ever linear, as this pandemic will tell us. But it is an interesting element that this pandemic, I think, has highlighted the frailty of human capital as an input into the economy, as an input into the production cycle. And therefore, outside of the serious economic consequences that we're going to see going forward, from the actual GDP elements all the way down to earnings and all the way over to the amount of debt that has to be picked up and serviced from here onwards by a host of governments, I think it also kind of makes us wonder what happens the next time there's a lightning strike, speaking of black swans, where, you know, the virus has a 30% kill rate and it's airborne. You know,
and carried by mosquitoes as well.
And carried by mosquitoes or pollen or something stupid like that. So, you know, again, it's the kinds of things where you're like, oh, okay, so we have the technology today to automate and protect and do all these things. And this might be a really big impetus for us to do that collectively. But are we ready from a societal point of view for what happens when we start to realize the gains from these automations, which are very exciting, very interesting, and so on? How do we ensure that people, you know, are empowered in their future world? Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a big topic.
I guess no one has the slightest idea about that.
No. But I think it's something that's good to be aware of and to bring to the front.
Totally.
Especially from people who are maybe at the edge of that technology, because I think such a small percentage of the population globally is technically aware or kind of very into this whole idea of what technology will do and how it will do it. And such a large percentage of the population is a receiver or is a client of that outcome, as opposed to a designer of it. And I'm just a little bit concerned that, I suppose, if we don't change that communication slightly more fairly, you might have a situation a little bit like Brexit. I was in London when Brexit happened. Mm-hmm. And you suddenly had this feeling that in London, if you were living in London, you were dead sure that Brexit would never go through. Why would you do that? That's just shooting yourself in the foot. It's terrible. But after the vote went through, you thought to yourself, oh, we forgot about everybody else. We forgot about this huge sway of the population that doesn't live in London. And I think in that moment, you kind of went, oh, okay, what happens if this similar type of problem starts bifurcating, you know, other parts of decision-making societies as well? So yeah, no, that's a fascinating area. Sorry, you just triggered me into that whole monologue. The question was for you, not to me, but anyway. Listen, thank you so much for your time, Igor.
Thank you very much, Mike. It was fun.